Casting. I'm your host, Lisa Zambetti. I'm a casting director for TV, film, video games, all kinds of things. I'll cast your bat mitzvah if you want me to. I'll cast anything, anywhere. And I love talking to people who are way smarter than me. And hence our guest today. Howard Fine is a renowned American acting teacher. He's the founder and artistic director of the Howard Fine Acting Studio with locations in Hollywood and Melbourne, Australia, and for over a quarter of a century, although he doesn't look a day over 25, folks, let me tell you, he's solidified his reputation as the foremost acting coach in Los Angeles. He's so sought after. He's worked with countless stars, award winners, including Oscar, Emmy, Golden Globe recipients, students such as Michelle Williams, Bradley Cooper, Kerry Washington, Brad Pitt, Salma Hayek, Justin Timberlake, and Austin Butler, just to name a few. He also has a new edition of his book, Fine on Acting. Please welcome Howard Fine.
I'm going to try to live up to that introduction, Lisa.
Oh my gosh. When your people reached out to me, yes, Howard has people. Like, I don't have people, but Howard has people. And they reached out to me and they're like, hey, would you like to have Howard come on and talk about the new edition of his book? I was like, the Howard Fine? It's like the Wizard of Oz.
Is he still alive?
It's just like something like it's such a, I don't want to say a brand, but it is a name that you see on people's, lots of people's resumes. And you hear it when anybody's who's asking anybody about who should I study with? Where should I go? There are a few people. Terry Knickerbocker is a friend and he's one of them. But Howard Fine is certainly a name like that. So welcome. And thank you for coming.
I'm delighted to be here.
So we can't start a conversation about Howard Fine and not start with a conversation about Uta. Now, there's a lot of people who may be listening, who may be new actors, who may not know the name Uta Hagen, but she certainly was a mentor and sounds like she became a colleague and friend of yours. And I have to say that my first day of my first class of my first year in graduate school as an actress, we did classic Uta Hagen exercise, which is just a private personal activity exercise. So for those of you who are listening, it's like you don't have any lines, you don't have a script, you don't have a scene partner, but you come in front of your class, you walk in and you just do an everyday activity.
You did the destination exercise.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe you're making a sandwich or you're making a cup of tea or you're folding laundry. And believe it or not, that doesn't sound like it's hard. It is got to be, for especially for a beginning actor, one of the hardest things you can.
Because it's just you up there. And it's not only the activity, it's pinning down the circumstances of that day. So you know where you've come from, what just happened, what you want, where you're going. And as you learn to pin that down in terms of circumstance, because we think we do the same things every day. We don't. You have a fight with your best friend the night before, your morning is different. It's raining. Your day is different. So it's learning. It's not any old day. It's that day. And then that transfers to scene work really well.
But just this exercise, just to learn to be yourself and not be self-conscious, is a huge thing.
It is enormous because one of the greatest misconceptions about acting is the idea of playing a character. We play so many characters in the course of a day. And who are they? They're all us. They're all parts of us. So learning that every character is already inside you.
Yes.
That's key.
But when I was a young actress, when I was a starting actress, let's just say, I used to think of a character is like putting on a coat, right? That you're putting these things on to become the character. And the older I got, the wiser I got, I really realized it's more about peeling it off, taking off the artifice, taking off the performative aspects of it and revealing intimacy and specificity. Am I right?
Especially on camera. The camera is an X-ray. If you do anything untruthful, I get asked that all the time. What's the difference between stage television and film acting? Not a lot. Good acting on stage is good acting on film. But bad acting is worse on film because the camera will magnify it. So if you're artificial in any way, camera's going to pick that up.
Absolutely. And I get that. I get asked a lot. I'm sure you do too. Like, what's the difference between stage acting, film acting, television acting? and I cast a lot of video games and video game acting. And yes, there are different things that you use, but good acting is good acting. And I think it's the same with drama and comedy. Like, what's the difference? It's not different.
There's not. The issue makes it funny. If I'm crying because somebody I love has passed away, it's drama. If I'm crying because I'm trying to get a pair of jeans two sizes too small over my butt, it's comedy. The right. investment is the same. The issue makes it funny.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think of it as built because I used to cast a procedural, like somebody could be chasing you with a knife and it's terrifying, or it could be really funny. It just depends on the context. But to that character, it is still life and death.
It has to be. And what are the, we get all the time, you got to make strong choices. Mm-hmm. And the actor thinks a strong choice is something they have to figure out in a clever way and impose. And I'll say a strong choice is authentic connection and investment. And so many actors get taught, especially with self-tapes, you better grab them immediately because they hear that a lot. And so they try to do something really kooky to get attention. And it's bad acting. And I say, yeah, you want to grab them? Be good.
I'm so glad I can't even tell you how this is just pinging with me, because this morning I teach for a group of Australian actors that come here every year.
We love the Australians.
So I was teaching them very early this morning, and there was a lot of that question you were just saying, how can I stand out in my auditions? Because they know that I'm working on a movie right now. I got 3,000 submissions for one role. And of those, I'm going to request, I don't know how many self-tapes. I don't know, 30, 40 self-tapes. So how, and they know that, I tell them that, and it's like, well, how do I stand out? And they hate my answer, but it's not a formula.
It's be real, be good, be honest. But they're thinking, and they're taught all the time, that they have to do something clever. Right. And that's what leads actors to doing really bad stuff. What I call, Lisa, garbage backstory. There's a ton of garbage backstory. In my online technique class, the first self-tip I give them is a reporter. It's a very straightforward scene. A reporter talking about the details of a murder case. Mm-hmm. So what should the actors know? What station do you work for? Do you think the right people have been apprehended? Who was the victim? What did she do? That's the stuff that you fill in that's not on the page, but you have to know.
Right.
I watch one tape and the guy's crying his eyes out, sobbing as delivering the reporter. And I said, what were you doing? It was my sister who was murdered. No, it wasn't your sister who was murdered. You're the reporter reporting on the case. The writer didn't forget to mention that.
Right, exactly.
And so that's the type of stuff that people insert trying to be creative, and they are shooting themselves in the foot right off the bat.
Well, it's exactly what you just said, is you do get told to make a strong choice, but that gets interpreted to be loud, or to be aggressive, or to be angry, or to be something. And that's really not what a strong choice is.
No, it means make it matter, right? Now, what happens is, I use baseball as an analogy sometimes. I'm a long-suffering Boston Red Sox fan.
My husband is too, yes.
All right, so we have something in common, but it's long-suffering, let's face it. But let me use baseball. The outfielder is running after a ball that's clearly out. He jumps with everything he's got. And he grabs the ball. Someone who doesn't know what they're doing comes along and says, I love that choice you made to jump. Well, I didn't choose to jump. I was trying to catch the ball. What comes out of you is a product of having a strong objective. When you know what you want and it matters to you, interesting stuff will happen if you allow it.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about the difference between process and technique. And what I mean by that is I taught for a lot of universities, and sometimes I'm hired to teach a class that I really want to teach, and they also rope you into teaching a few classes you don't want to teach. And so sometimes they'll have me teach a beginning acting class, which I don't have a problem with, but you really have to teach what I think of as process, right? And then when you have more kind of established actors, kind of like who you coach, it's really more fine-tuning, redirecting, reminding people what is your why. So process is so hard to teach. And
because we are, I didn't mean to interrupt you. We are such a result-oriented society. And I'm guilty too. If a website doesn't download in seconds, you go to the next. And we become very impatient because we want immediate results. And creativity doesn't work that way. The process is messy. It's full of trial and error. And you have to be willing to make mistakes. But what I find so many people want is perfection rather than process.
Right.
And give me a formula that's easy, doesn't cost me any time or energy, and will lead to a fantastic result. Well, right. There's no such
right.
Doesn't work that way.
I think also, I don't know if you agree with me, but when I'm teaching those kind of classes, I really start, like what we were saying, I start with like, can you be you for five minutes and not have to, like a lot of people do that OODA exercise and they try to be cheeky and they like go to the
bathroom. Or they try to perform.
Yeah. Or they do something really like scandalous, like, oh, I'm going to take a crap or something. And like, that's it. Yeah. You know, because they want to be interesting. And it's like, no, let's just start with you. Can you be you?
Yes. And if you are, you will be interesting. If you try to be interesting, you'll indicate, or in other words, be artificial. So an interested actor, an interested human being, that's where you want to be, not trying to project. We got to get the attention off the audience, off the reaction you want from the audience. Because the minute you do that and you try to perform, you are going to be awful.
Right. And then after you feel like good in your own skin, like settled, like I can just be myself and relax, then I try to take them, okay, now can you be someone you know really well, right? Your mom, your sister, somebody who you've observed and you really know their voice and you know everything about them. Can you step into their shoes and do the same thing, but as them? And then you kind of start extending it. Okay, now can you be someone you don't know them, but you've seen them every day? It's the barista you've always seen. And you start extending. Now can you be someone you've never seen and you have no reference point for, and you need only your imagination to step into
and
that.
And ultimately to find where they live inside you so that you're not doing an imitation in the end. And I'll give you an example. If Austin Butler had done an imitation of Elvis, it would have been career ending. He could have just signed up for a job in Vegas, because who needs one more Elvis impersonator? But our entire process working on that was to find where Elvis lived inside Austin. So yes, there's a voice. Yes, there's mannerisms. Yes. But in the end, you have to connect it to a part of yourself. Otherwise, you're putting it on, and then that's bad acting.
Exactly. And I'm so glad you mentioned that. That was one of the things I was going to ask you about. When you're coaching somebody who is playing a real person, especially a well-known person, it's like you have to play the song with the notes that the audience connects with. They need that ping of recognition. But like you say, you can't be doing an impersonation. That must be such a hard line.
That's a very, very difficult line. I remember the same year that Philip Seymour Hoffman won an Oscar for Capote, there was another Capote done at the same time. Now, that was a better imitation.
It was Toby Jones.
Okay. But Philip Seymour Hoffman, doesn't physically resemble Truman Capote, but he wasn't imitating. He found the mannerisms, he found the voice, but then he connected it to himself.
Exactly.
And that's what made that performance so spectacular. So in the end, if we're playing a real person, it's finding where that person lives inside you. But there's homework involved, obviously. And then if it's a lesser well-known person, there's still homework to do because that person's alive. I helped Will Smith play Dr. Bennett Omalu in the movie Concussion. And Dr. Omalu is the doctor who discovered CTE, the concussions that football players get.
Wow.
And he's got an accent. He's got a physicality. I watch tapes of Dr. Omalu. Will spend time with him. What does Dr. Omalu do for a living? He performs autopsies. Will observed Dr. Omalu perform two autopsies from beginning to end. And as he described it to me, it begins with a diagonal slice across the cadaver. Said he almost passed out watching. But he had to educate himself because in the movie, he's Dr. Omalu performing an autopsy. Yeah. And sometimes when I'm interviewed on various entertainment broadcasts, they will, with a sneer, say, oh, yeah, what is actors' homework? Laughing as if there's no such thing. Or they think acting is easy. And I'll say, well, look, the Olympics are coming up. No one sits in the audience. I don't sit on my couch watching the diving thinking I can do any of those.
Right, exactly.
They look hard. But great acting, when acting's done well, you can't see the technique. And so everyone thinks they can do it. And they'll look at me and say, but that's really hard. And I say, well, so is acting. If we were to give, you know this, if we were to give a scene to 10 people on the street, I'm thinking it was the scene from The Crown where the father, Muhammad Al-Fayed, walks into the morgue, sees his son, and screams out to God. Imagine giving that scene to 10 people on the street. We would have the greatest blooper reel ever.
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to get into the self-tape because I loved in your book what you write. And we're going to get to your book. Oh, my gosh. But one thing I want to tell you that drives me a little crazy, and I want to know how you feel about this. So I taught for the Actors Studio in New York for a time. And nothing drives me crazier than when somebody refers to an actor as being very method. Like, because the word method has become synonymous with crazy. Like, yeah. Oh, it's Jared Leto. He's so method. It's like, that is not the method. That is a method. That's a process. But that's not, and I'm so, it just offends me so much. And especially, that's like no respect for legacy, for one thing, which as Uda being your mentor, that's a certain legacy. And certainly when I was on the faculty at the Actors Studio, these faculty meetings, people fighting about what Lee really wanted, what Lee Strasberg really wanted and what he would do and what they should be doing, they take it really seriously. But to have somebody called method as because they're difficult or whatever that is.
It's come to mean overindulgent, unhealthy. Well, will observing Dr. Omalu perform an autopsy? That's actor's homework. Now, trying to present himself as a doctor at some hospital, that would be insane.
Right.
So we don't do that. But we have to know that there is homework involved. You might have to learn a physicality. You might have to learn legal or medical jargon. You've got work to do if you are going to be believable in certain parts. That's actor's homework. If you're playing a homeless character, do you need to spend a year on the streets? That's what they need. Oh, that's the method. But you still have homework to do. It's a responsibility as an actor.
Yeah, and each actor needs different things.
And it's interesting to do. It opens us as human beings. An interesting television series called Babylon Berlin, which is set in Berlin in the 1920s. It's a German series. The lead actor, Volker Bruch, when he was cast, set in the 1920s, he started to wear a suit every day because his character wears a suit. Then he got the fedora hat. Then he got a straight-edged razor and learned how to shave with it because he's doing that in the show. Mm-hmm. Then he listened to the music of the time and started learning the dance steps. That is homework. That's not method or overindulgent or insane. It's called what you need to do to play that truthfully.
Absolutely. And as you were talking about his wardrobe is really important, especially in self-tapes. It is, and I don't mean costuming.
No, don't wear the costume, but dress in the direction of the character.
Yes, dress.
Right? If you're arguing in front of the Supreme Court, don't wear a sweatshirt and don't wear anything with writing on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, just today I was giving my little talk to my Australian actors and I said, look, if you're going to play an FBI agent or a lawyer, wear a fucking suit that fits you because you're going to feel like you have more status and status is incredibly important. You're going to move differently and wearing hard sole shoes, you know?
It does some of the work for you. It is an underused acting tool. Clothing conditions change of self. What we wear changes our self-concept and our physicality exactly right.
Right.
And dress in the direction of the character. Now, if you take scene study class with me, yes, I want every costume and prop known to man because we're trying to be on set in scene study. We're trying to have all of the things we can have. But self-tape is an in-between hybrid world.
It is.
And you want to give yourself every advantage, but you don't want to look desperate.
No, you don't want to dress like in a real cop uniform. That's not necessary.
And because you're going to think, watching it, that the person's insane, has nothing going on in their life. This is the only thing. And they went out and bought the uniform.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, I did a study a couple years ago where I went back to every single hard drive, every single EcoCast of every audition that I'd ever cast. Because I was very curious, if I went back and watched the actor who booked the role, right? What would they all have in common, right? And so I made a big database and I would watch the audition and I would make a little check like, oh, they did that, check. Check, check, check. Oh, they didn't do that. Oh, I thought this would be significant. It wasn't. And then at the end of the day, after 300, 500, 1,000 actors who booked, I had a pretty fucking great set of data points there. And dressing to suggest was a big one. And also what you said about, now, you don't want to be over propping just for the sake of propping, but the number of actors who used activity, and sometimes that means using a prop, taking on and off your glasses, taking off a sweater, coming through the door with your real handbag, looking for your real keys. things that your character would be doing. Or like you're having an argument with your wife and you're like drying a dish or you're putting something away the way that you would be. That is a very underrated human thing to add to your audition.
Yes, if it's pertinent, necessary, and furthers your intent in the scene. So if at the end of the conversation you say cheers and you pull up a glass with some grape juice in it to do the toast, fine. If you add things that are unnecessary or distract, you got to be careful with it.
So you have to really curate that and edit and be strategic. And I think the bad use of props is what makes a lot of casting directors and a lot of my colleagues say, just
say
don't.
No props. And I say generally keep it to a minimum, but it better serve you. So, for example, I was working on a scene where she said, a young girl in the scene says, I've got to get to class. And she picked up her backpack and put it on. Fantastic.
Right.
Totally relevant. Makes sense in the circumstance. So there's no 100% rule to anything. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen people use glasses incorrectly where they'll slate without the glasses on. And the character's supposed to be smart. So now they're somebody who doesn't wear glasses normally. But they put them on because, you see, now when I put the glasses on, I'm a smart person. I wasn't before.
Yeah.
That's going to be highly suspicious. So you have to be careful.
Absolutely. That's really true. But I just find that sometimes, even if it's not in the frame of the self-tape, if you've got something that you're doing.
That, I teach a whole class on how to handle physical action on a self. And one of my students booked a role because of it, on recurring as a paramedic, because she knew how to set it up below camera line. So that she's doing something specific with her body that looks deliberate, not just general, and that gives an impression of what's happening in the scene. But again, you have to be careful. I had one student do a medical scene. He was looking down the entire time.
Yeah.
And I said, you can't do that. And he said, my wife's a doctor. She kept telling me, the patient. Yeah, she's right. They're not going to hire the best surgeon. They're going to hire the best actor. You've got seconds to make an impression. We have to see you.
I hate to say this because I've cast a lot of medical examiners, a lot of cops, a lot of military people, a lot of FBI agents, SWAT and everything. The worst people at it sometimes are the people who've really done it.
That's right.
Because they're fighting internally so much with what's going on the page. And I've said so many times, it's like, wait a minute, you are a doctor. Why are you just sucking at this scene? I mean, I didn't say it like that, but, you know, and they'd be like, because I would never say it like this. And I'm like,
yes, right.
That's not your job right now.
They'll say to me, there's a medical mistake in this scene. Should I tell them that up front? And I will say, wait till you get hired.
Yes.
Maybe you can subtly talk to someone.
Exactly.
But right. You can't. You have to go with the what's written and what the scene is about. We're not hiring the best doctor. We're hiring the best actor.
It's so true. So let's talk about the new edition of your book, which is Fine on Acting. So when did you first write this book?
About 2 years ago. Uh-huh. And as I progressed through the years, I've grown, learned. Self-tape wasn't even a thing when I first wrote the book. Mm-hmm. So that needed an update. And I've become very aware of the different ways people can go wrong creating a backstory. And I've learned a lot about how to get more succinct and more clear. So I thought it was time to revise.
I mean, we're going to talk about self-tapes in a second because I love what you write in your book. But do you think that now that actors now have any worse, harder, different problems or issues than they ever did? Or is that architecture of the craft still the same?
Some of it's the same. Technology is changing and we have to roll with that. I think self-tapes are the best thing that ever happened to an actor because you can control it. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite quotes is by a speaker named Ayanla Banzan. It's the way you do one thing is the way you do everything. The way you do one thing is the way you do everything. So if you can control it and you don't have it properly framed, lit, good sound, good lighting, nice, even lighting, not hyper-concentrated on the face or dark in shadows. If you can control it and you do not take the time to learn what is a proper self-tape, first technically, because let's face it, when you turn on a self-tape, the first hit you get is, how does it look? Can I see them? Can I hear them? Yeah. Do they know how to put together a proper self-tape? So that, the way you do one thing is the way you do everything. Then, do they memorize the material? And can you memorize it word for word? Yes, some shows have improvisation. Some shows don't. And the writer is often part of the casting process. for heaven's sake, if you're auditioning for Aaron Sorkin, say the words he wrote. For heaven's sake, say them. So you've got to learn, get the discipline to learn that, and you have to have a good reader and more points to come if you want me to discuss it further.
Yeah. Well, first thing I want to say is that came up today about improvisation during your scene. Now, I've worked on a bunch of comedies for NBC where some of the writers loved when an actor would improvise. And some people were like, just say my fucking words, please.
That's right.
But I worked really hard on this joke and I need to have like six jokes land before the commercial. Please just deliver it. So you have to be careful. And it seems like sometimes improvisation is I recommend if you're going to do it, if you have the impulse to do it, bookending the scene with it, ending with an extra flourish of something or a button, or starting with something that gets you into the scene is kind of the safest places to do it. But yeah, I mean, writers work really hard to get the exact word and the exact tone. And it's good if you can do it, especially if they're in the position of being the decision maker of the casting.
And chances are the writer wrote something better than you are coming up. And in my poor news reporter scene that I give, if they get it wrong, they change the details of the case. And you can't do that. So you've got to discipline yourselves for word-for-word memorization. Now, again, if it says, feel free to improvise this section, you're going to get that in the direction. The other thing that I'm going to tell everybody, read the directions from every casting office. They're different. How they want the slate, how they want it framed. They're different. And they can tell right away whether or not you follow instructions.
Yeah.
And that can be disqualifying right off the bat, right? Because how are you going to be to work with if you don't follow directions?
And we do try as much as we can. Sometimes we're under NDAs. We can't really give you any extra information in the breakdown or in the self-tape instructions. But we do try to sort of give you hints on what is going to make you successful. And so it's good if we see people listening to that. I do want to go back to what you said about memorization. And just as a disclaimer, as you know, per SAG-AFTRA, as casting directors, we cannot demand that any actor memorize their words. And there are big reasons for that. And you may agree or disagree out there. It has become kind of a political football a little bit, this concept. But I can tell you that the more prepared you are, the more you have your face off the page, the more I can access you, the better.
The competition is too stiff.
Yeah.
At any one point, 98% of SAG is unemployed.
Yeah.
That's not counting the people trying to get into SAG. And so you've got to be at the very top of your game. Now, I have strong feelings about the fact that actors should be protected in terms of how much time they get to prepare.
Yep.
I've seen people night before get 15 pages for the next day. And that's general. I mean, if there's a disaster and somebody takes ill and you've got a last minute recast a role, maybe that's understandable. But for the most part, your project is casting, and give people time to prepare. So in defense of the actors, there should be adequate time to prepare. But given that you have time to prepare, you got to memorize.
And just for actors who are listening, as your union, if you're in SAG-AFTRA, worked very, very hard to make this a sticking point in the new contract where we have to do our very best to give you at least 48 hours with the material. Now, there is a caveat in there that sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes it's a recasting at the last minute.
Emergency, that's different.
So you have to be able to roll with that. You have to be able to do that. And there are some people, that's a real skill. Some people are really good at memorization or cold reading, but your skills need to be kind of on point to be able to pivot to that if you need to. I remember we were casting an episode of Criminal Minds, and this actor Brady Smith came in. I don't know if you ever know Brady, but he's wonderful. And he came in as the bad guy, right? He's auditioning as the bad guy. And he wore like a black shirt. And he's such a nice guy. You know, I don't even know why we brought him in for that, because he's so sweet. But he did a great job. But the director said, you're wonderful, but I want you to read for this other thing. And so we gave him 8 pages and said, can you step out and come back an hour later? Come back 2 hours later. We'll still be here when you're ready. That motherfucker came in 20 minutes later. He had changed his shirt, was in like much softer plaid shirt, and he was off book, absolutely not even in his hand. Howard, he didn't even have it in his hand. And we were impressed by that, but it was like, and he just nailed it. He had such a quick process
because he was in shape. And it's long been taught, folded in your hand, your lower expectations. If you've ever made a recipe and you have the recipe anywhere near, it's kryptonite. You'll check it thousand times. A script in an actor's hand is, you will lose your confidence and double check constantly to make sure you're saying the right words.
It's true.
And so you've got to develop the skill to memorize. It is a skill and it's part of the job.
I have to agree that the people in my study that I mentioned, my database, 95, 98% of the actors who booked didn't even have the script in their hand because they were doing other things with their hands. They were full of life, full of
action. No actor ever got better holding a script.
Now, there are some offices, I know a very famous office who demands that you hold the script. And of course, if that's their protocol, you should.
If they're holding a gun to your head, you got to do what you got to do.
But that's because they've been affected by actors who think that they're off book. And they come in and they're not. And so they melt down, they collapse. And it's like, oh, just hold your sides. And when that happens in a producer session, it can be very high stakes. I mean, a producer can be like, why did you bring this person in if they're not ready? If they're, you know.
So, then they'll blame the casting director.
Yeah. What else? What are the other nuggets in this new version of your book that you might like to give us a sneak peek on? I do want people to go out and buy it, but I want you to tell us what are kind of some of the new nuggets that you have.
Well, I really do want to talk about backstory. Do not sit at your computer and write 80 pages that you will never remember. If you have to read your backstory, it's of no use to you. I would start a notebook. First, read your script over and over and over again. Anything you miss in the script, you're going to miss something actable. So you have to be a detective when you first pick up a script to get every bit of information out of it that you possibly can. Then, based on what the writer has given you, fill in what's not there, but what would be logical, not trying to do the work of the writer or to create a completely different script, but to justify what the writer wrote, to get you to connect to it. I find, and I share this in the new book, the best way to do a backstory is visually, is to put together a visual collage, because we're able to do that without judgment. And I want to talk in a second about judging the character.
Sure.
But what you're able to do visually is, where were you born? Your parents, your schools, your family. You can use photos you find on the internet, and you can use actual things from your own life if they work. And then you tweak the backstory. Let's say you're doing my reporter exercise. Then you didn't go to college for acting. You went to college for journalism.
So that's right. Yes.
You tweak it. But you use as much of yourself as possible and put together the visuals. We think in images, not in words. And so actors, bad actors, are the only people who say words without images. In life, we can't do it. Even when we're lying. Oh, I'm so sorry I was late. There was an accident on the 405. You better picture it if you want people to be it. So when you put together the visual collage, it helps your memorization. Because if you can picture what you're talking about, it will come to you. A great exercise when you first read a script, when you first read a scene, flip it over and see what you can remember. What you can't remember, you don't have images for. And that tells you the work that you need to do. Now, judging the character, I talk about almost on every page of the book. It is the most common of the acting mistakes. We do not psychoanalyze our character. We do not. My character is an arrogant narcissist. You're going to find yourself moving 10 feet away from it.
Yeah. Right?
You have got to find where you live in every character. But to do that, you have to know yourself. You have to know every part of yourself from light to dark. My favorite thing that actors will say, and I mean this sarcastically, oh, I would never do that.
Yes.
First of all, how in the world do you know what you would do and what you wouldn't do? How many times in your own life do you shock yourself? Oh, that was out of character for me. Why did I do that? And yet you can blithely look at a scene and say, I would never do that. The operative question for actors is not what would I do? It's what would make me do this? What would make me do this? When you find that connection, you start to say, okay, I get it. Then there's a big divide in the acting world as between the Strasberg people who only use emotional recall and the Meisner people who only use imagination.
Well, it's like the Catholics and the Protestants. It's
absolutely. I used to refer to it as a schism, ironically, but my students would look at me blankly, not knowing what a schism was.
Right.
But yes, it is that way. To me, that's half a toolbox. I have a student who got the lead in an independent film where he's playing a character who gets sent away for anger management issues. That happened to him in real life. So what is he supposed to do? Put the real experience away and go, what if I got sent away for anger management? He knows. He lived it. He has that issue. On the other side, I hope to God you have to use your imagination.
Yeah.
Can you imagine looking at every script and going, oh, I remember when I was kidnapped.
Right.
We use both.
Yeah.
And in the end, we use a combination of real things and imagination. in order to believe what the writer has given us. So judging the character takes you away from the character. So when you speak about a role, I insist everybody speak in the first person, I, because it's about finding identification, finding yourself in every role.
Absolutely. I used to really torture myself, Howard, when I was an early actor, because I would try to dig up real biographical things in my real life that would torment me so I could do the scene. And as I got older and more experienced, I didn't have to do that so much. I could find the empathy in a character just by...
However you connect to it.
Yeah.
You're right, Lisa. It's akin to making a friend. When we make a friend, we find things in common with that person. When you pick up a script, that's what you start to do. Actors spend too much time on how they're different than a character. That's a dead end. Spend all of your time on what I have in common until it's you.
You said something that just reminded me of something this morning. You said you had an actor, like, I would never do that, or putting things into the script. So today there was I gave somebody a scene of a man who was grieving the death of his wife. He's doing the scene and I was like, there's something wrong here. I can put my finger on it, but there's something wrong here. And we were talking about aftercare. Oh, well, I've decided that he killed her. And I was
right.
Like, okay, but that is not in this scene. And please play why and ask yourself not what do I want from this scene, but why did the writer write this scene? Why is this scene here? Because they didn't have to write this scene. We didn't have to have this scene with the grieving husband. It could have been the two cops saying, yeah, we interviewed the husband and he's not our suspect. But they wrote this scene. Why? And in my world, it's for pain. The writer wants the audience to.
Yeah, and is writing a eulogy. I ask my students, you want to get better at script analysis? Write a 2 to 3 page scene. You do not have to turn it in. No one need ever see it. But write it. You will agonize even over the names of the characters, the location, the circumstance, the dialogue.
Yeah.
You agonize over it, only for an actor to come along and decide why none of that matters. And this is what it's about.
Right.
So you want to get better script analysis, write a 2 to 3 page scene, and it's going to help you see nothing is there by accident. Mm-hmm. And you don't get to make that decision. That's not a choice. That's violating the intent of the act of the writer. And that makes you a bad actor. I mean, the decisions that people make, reporter, again, I'm going to use my poor reporter scene because I see so many crazy things done with it. It's my first report. I'm really nervous. Well, how would a casting office know you chose that? It's not in the scene. They're just going to think you look nervous on camera. Do not make those types of decisions. You're violating what the author wrote.
Well, plus a reporter, even if they're nervous, they don't want to seem nervous.
No, they try to cover it anyway, but that's the decision.
Yeah.
If the recipe is for a salad, don't decide shark meat might improve it. I mean, you're coming up with crazy stuff.
So we're going to pivot to the Oscars in 1 second. I just had a thought about rehearsal boredom. And when you're an actor and you get your scene and at first you're like, oh my God, you're so in love with the scene and it's so fresh and you're making all these discoveries and you're doing your this and you're doing your that. And then after a while, you do it a few times and it starts to get kind of boring, you know? And you're like, I got this. And that moment for me, that's what separates the real actors from the people who are just not taking this that seriously. Because that moment of boredom is crucial.
Yeah, but it goes to the way you do one thing is the way you do everything. That is a person who cannot concentrate. Because when we were children, we could watch the same movie again and again and get equally excited every time.
Right.
And as actors, you have to cultivate a childlike naivete that allows you to do it every time as if for the first time. And so what happens is that's why a lot of actors, they get bored with the scene and they start imposing terrible ideas to keep it fresh rather than learning to do it again and again as if for the first time as part of craft.
Right. And the discovery and stuff. But so many people come into my office, Howard, and they'll fall apart, right? And they'll be like, I don't get it. I had this at home.
Yeah, because no one was watching at home.
Right.
We're about to watch the Olympics. Some people are going to rise to that moment and some people are not. Can you work under pressure as if there's no pressure?
Right.
Can you rehearse publicly? The Germans have a word for rehearsal called Probe. The English derivative is probe. Mm-hmm. If you treat every time you work as a chance to investigate, to find, to discover, so that you never think about performance, you're always in process.
Exactly.
I've said that to my students opening night on Broadway. It's just another rehearsal.
That's a great.
And they're able to walk out when, this is just a fun story. when my longtime student, and I really don't call her a student anymore, she's my collaborator, Carla Gugino, was just such a...
Oh, my God. Isn't that what, that...
Yeah, she is a treasure.
Yes.
And I just worked with her yesterday on a new project. Carla was doing Suddenly Last Summer on Broadway. And I happened to be in New York coinciding, and her assistant got me the ticket. And I would never have chosen this seat to see somebody I know. The stage was the same plane as the audience, and I was dead center. And I thought, oh my God, don't see me. Please, the last thing you want to do is see your coach sitting in the front row. And when she walked up for her entrance, I thought she saw me, but I just tried to make myself look smaller and look away. Anyway, after the show, I went backstage and she went, Howard, I walked out and I saw you, and then you'll be proud of me. I thought for a second, oh, there's Howard. And then I didn't think about you for the rest of the show.
Oh, my God.
Thank goodness. But it's such an interesting thing to develop concentration to the point where you can play. Think what a good word play is. Teleplay, screenplay, play. Mm-hmm. If you can stay loose and free and easy under pressure. But I'll bet you that actor who falls apart in your office is not in class. Because if you're in class, you're putting up work in front of people. It's not such pressure in terms of being hired and fired, but it's enough to work out. You can't just expect, you don't prepare for the Olympics four weeks before the Olympics.
I do think acting training is like being an athlete 100% or even a musician. And you have to just practice, you just have to keep practicing even when you're bored with the scene. And I think it's not so much lack of training, it's underestimating what is there, what is on the page.
I would say that's an and. That's on all of the above. Mm-hmm. It's all of those things. It's a fast food society. Mm-hmm. And you get so many people who arise to fame through reality shows and influencers and all these types of things. And then the instant thought is, well, okay, this could be quick. I can be famous. I can be everything I want to be instantly.
Yeah.
And that's not, this is a craft. It takes years of work.
I was just going to say craft. Well, you want to talk Oscars?
I do.
All right. So I have to say I have a very cranky relationship with the Oscars, to be totally honest with you, because I love the elevation of performances and all that and celebrating great actors and underrepresented artists and all that shit. That's all great. But what I can't stand is that the criteria for best is just there. What are we saying here with the best?
No, you can't. Listen, I love that we have the Oscars. I love that we celebrate great work. Most of us who ended up in the industry were fans as children and who didn't watch the Oscars.
Of course. Yes.
Right. And we fell in love with it. And so that's still there. That's in my blood. But no, I can't say this is the best over that. They're all different.
Yeah.
When the work gets to be so wonderful, and also each of us has our own taste.
Right.
What I love in a movie, I particularly love The Holdovers. And I love Paul Giamatti. I just think he's a journeyman actor. And he makes me care about everything that he does, his investment. And I can hear him really well. This year, there's some mumble acting.
Well, let's go talk about it. Tumble.
Yeah, I have to get this off my chest. I'm going to be the crankiest old man on the planet, Lisa. It's coming. I'm going to be the guy sitting there going, hey, what? Speak up. I ask my students, how many of you have to put on subtitles, even when it's in English? And a lot of them raise their hand because there are a lot of young actors, especially, who think they're going to be natural. And by natural, they mumble. Mm-hmm. They think that's more real. And I'm seeing some of that even on the Oscar stage. And what you've got to realize is it's not about projection, because you can do an intimate scene and be quite quiet, but still be heard and still be understood. Sound engineers love my students. I get that, because they can do a quiet scene, but still have the will for the words. I can be talking to you in a very soft voice and you'll hear me and understand me. Mm-hmm. But what happens is some of these actors have, they can yell and then they have nothing. It's just right there. And that's not real. That's somebody playing an attitude of trying to be natural. So what do I love about Paul Giamatti? He uses his voice. So does Jeffrey Wright, American Fiction. Right. That's another great performance, right? Great storytelling. And Emma Stone, Poor Things. Wow. And Willem Dafoe and Mark Ruffalo. These actors are just, they're journeyman actors.
Oh, absolutely. I guess I'm torn as I'm trying to think about criteria. Like, should we be rooting for, like, the hardest acting job? That's got to go hands down to Annette Bening, right? Or are we talking about transformation? And then your pal Bradley Cooper transforming, Robert Downey Jr. transforming. Or is it the passion and the rousing nature of Colman Domingo, who I've cast before, or Daniel Brooks? I mean, there are so many different things that you could be championing. It's
yes.
Very, very difficult.
I totally agree with that. And so sometimes it's been transformation, Robert De Niro and Raging Bull, right? Gaining weight, losing weight. Those things tend to be impressive. Learning accents, learning, those things can impress. But you can't really compare when you've got master actors working. I loved Annette Bening as Nyan. She totally transformed. And that's another example of finding her own connection to it. Because in the end, she didn't imitate Nyan. She found where Nyan lives inside her. And that's not her every day.
Yeah.
That's not Annette Bening's every day. When Sean Penn played Harvey Milk, he found his own connection to it.
You sing in my song. There is no cheer that I cheered louder than when he won for that. I got to tell you. I mean, brilliant.
Because he made it come from him. It didn't seem as if that could have, again, been a disaster if he had done an imitation. But he found where it lived inside him. That's a lot of work. But that's a master actor. And so we've got a lot of good movies, a lot of stellar work to look at. It was a pleasure to watch everything. I also love the foreign film that's nominated, Anatomy of a Fall. She's in two pieces this year, Zone of Interest and then Sandra Huller. And boy, is she talented.
Yeah, isn't it great? Well, see, this is the one I want to ask you. So most of us probably don't know her unless you've been watching a lot of German TV or whatever. And so she's not coming along with the baggage that a lot of actors are sort of intrinsically fighting against. Now, look, I'm Italian. It's a law that I love Robert De Niro. I mean, I just have to. But there's a certain part of me that doesn't get submersed in his
Because government. You recognize him as De Niro, although he's great. And
yes, he is. Of course he is. But I haven't really felt a transformation in him since Cape Fear. Like, that's the last time I really felt like, yeah, I don't recognize
this. Well, you see De Niro when you see him at this
yeah,
point.
Yeah, yeah. Or anybody who has any kind of baggage, even like Mark Ruffalo, who really isn't known for being this kind of kooky, whacked out character. They're sort of battling their own reputation when they're taking on something.
Absolutely. And yet you watch him for a while and you get sucked in.
Yeah.
And sure. I'm watching him right now. I'm going to watch the final episode of All the Light We Cannot See. Tonight I'm watching. I've got to brace myself for the final episode. But his work in that, again, these are actors who've spent their lives doing this. And I want to share a nice story about him. This was years ago. One of my students was working catering an event and Mark Ruffalo was there. And he came into the kitchen and he told everybody to sit down. Let me serve you. I used to do this. And I know how it feels. And that's just a great story.
Glenn Close was on Broadway doing Sunset Boulevard. And I was very young and I was catering the opening night party. And I was standing in the back of the theater watching and just feeling so far away. Like, I'm just a few feet from the stage, but I could not be farther. Here I am in this ill-fitting tuxedo and all this stuff. And she came up to each of us after the party and just tracked each of us down and shook our hand and said, thank you so much for your work. And she knew that we
and didn't forget what that is. If I go to any party in Hollywood, who recognizes me immediately is the waiter, the catering staff, because they're actors. So I can get a drink and hors d'oeuvres faster than anyone. But every time I do, I'm reminded of how people are making their money to be in class, to afford headshots, to put together their reels, to do all the things that they have to do and survive in LA, which is very, very expensive. And I never lose sight because my dad was a mechanic, right? I grew up pumping gas. I didn't come from any of this.
Right.
And so I never forget where I came from either. And this is the hardest thing that anybody could ever do as a profession. And that's why I say to my students, if anything else makes you happy, do that. If only this makes you happy, then don't take no for an answer. Then it's your passion. But it has to be your passion. It can't be casual.
Right. Well, what's clear to me is your passion is actors and helping actors and setting them on their journey and keeping them on the right path. And you are just, I mean, it's such an honor to meet you and to pick your brain and to talk to you about your, you know, your philosophy and your how you champion people. And I'm just so pleased that you took the time to come and talk to me. Is there anything else that we need to talk about before I let you go?
I have the workbook that accompanies my book coming out April 3rd on Amazon, and it's going to be a practical series of applications of all of the things that are mentioned in my book. So if you want a practical application, and in the way that the artist's way is a way to be accountable, we created the workbook so that it would be a way to be accountable to what I teach in the book.
That's so wonderful, because right now people I know are feeling, you know, kind of very isolated and kind of on their own sometimes. So having a workbook that you can really refer to and feel connected to your mentor, to your teacher, I think that's really, really important. So that's great. And I will definitely let people know about that and link it in my socials too when it comes out. Thank you, Howard, for coming today. And for now, this is Killer Casting signing off.